Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight on Mages, Sages, and Seers, I'll be speaking with Barbara Nolan, who recently authored A Year of Pagan Prayer, a source book of poems, hymns, and invocations from 4,000 years of pagan history. Yes, you heard me correctly, 4,000 years. Greetings and welcome, Barbara. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I was very impressed by your book. That is quite a range of time that is covered in the book, as well as a range of locations.
Yes, yes, I hope so. Certainly, I wanted to emphasize the fact that not only does paganism have a really, really ancient past, it also continued, at least in a literary sense, pretty much in an unbroken line from antiquity to the present day, which is to say that even after Christianity became the official religion of the Western world, authors continued to write hymns and sonnets and poems in honor of pagan gods, almost as if Christianity never happened. So I thought that that was something that was really interesting and that modern pagans could use to give some depth and some tradition to their modern practices.
And that is a very important point. Even into the Christian era, a lot of people who we would now call pagans did continue to write. And in fact, I was amazed to discover that you had quoted from Nonnus, his Dionysiaca, which is a very little known work. I happen to have the entire Dionysiaca post commentaries. But I was very surprised to find Nonnus. Usually when I talk about Nonnus, people's eyes glaze. But he's a good example. He wrote also on Christian religious themes, as well as writing his epic on Dionysus, which is, I think, one of the longest epic poems in history.
Yes, yes, indeed. And it's really extraordinary how this, I wouldn't really go quite so far as to call it a dual faith, but how this sort of dual tradition just carried on in the West. I don't know. I've read a bit of Arabic poetry. I haven't read a great deal, but I don't think anything happened in a similar fashion in the East. Like, I don't think poets in Saudi Arabia continued to write hymns to, you know, the pagan deities of the region, you know, after the conversion to Islam. So what happened in the Western world, I think, is really extraordinary. And we really should be very grateful. We're really lucky that that happened.
Yeah, yes, we're definitely very, very lucky that that happened. And you're a scholar, a true scholar. You speak several languages. And would you care to share some of the background with us?
Well, I didn't speak any of them very well. I can read French pretty well. I had Irish, Gaelic, when I was a little girl. I think my first classes were when I was about 13, and I did study it in college. It has gotten very rusty because I don't have many people to speak it with, as you may imagine. And then I did Latin in high school and in college. And I had a little bit of Greek in college, although I had more classes on Greek philosophy and Greek religion. I was lucky enough to actually take classes in, we had a class on the cults, specifically on the cults of Demeter and Dionysus, which was wonderful. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
but I love languages.
I can see that. What inspired this journey? When did this love of ancient literature start in your life?
Okay, well, as far as the literature goes, separate from paganism, I'm going to be completely honest and say that when I was very young, probably around 7 years old, I saw a chopped up version of Elizabeth Taylor's Cleopatra on television, and immediately decided that I wanted to be Cleopatra and headed off to the local library and started checking out biographies of, you know, children's biographies of Cleopatra and then Caesar, and then it escalated pretty quickly from there. You know, and within a few years I was reading Suetonius, and yeah, just basically loving the Julio-Claudians, who are a bunch that you can read about and never tire if you like drama.
Mm-hmm.
So that got me started, and then, you know, I was fortunate enough that in my high school there was still a Latin class that had about 5 people in it, so I was able to start learning Latin then.
Oh, very cool. Is that how your spirituality did your spirituality spring from that adventure?
So not directly. What actually happened was, if you hadn't guessed already, I was a bookish child. And one day, I was raised moderately Catholic, you know, not in a strict sense, but I went to, we would go to church on the big holidays, and I went to CCD, to catechism classes, at one point. And I was crushed, though, to discover that I couldn't become a priest, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I did go through a period of time when I was like 6 and 7, where I had a little altar set up at the foot of my bed, and I would make like fake communion wafers out of white bread and wine out of grape juice. But the thing that actually brought me to paganism was sitting down when I was about 9 to read the Bible. And I was completely shocked because I was a post-Vatican II Catholic. So the big emphasis was like, God is love, you know, God loves you. The head nun at the school that was attached to the church that we went to, you know, even promulgated the idea that hell was a place in your mind that existed when you cut yourself off from God's love. So this was very, like, sort of Catholicism light. And when I sat down to read the Bible, naturally I started at the beginning. And I was getting more and more confused. I didn't know who Yahweh was, because that's not a name that's brought up much in Catholicism. I'm going, who is this terrible person who's, like, talking about, you know, the necessity of killing people and killing babies? And then I figured out what was going on. I was like, oh no, I don't think that this is for me. And I was also sort of deeply suspicious right at the beginning with the whole Adam and Eve story. I was like, this feels like this is not going to work for me as a female.
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided, because I did have a background in the classics, I was also really interested in Celtic history at a very young age. Since my last name is Nolan, that will not be a surprise. And I just was like, okay, I can't do Christianity. Can't do it. I had no desire to be an atheist. So I was like, well, I know that my ancestors at one point in time used to do something different, and I think I'll just do that. So I did. I set up a little altar outside under an apple tree, and away I went. I didn't know that anybody else in the world practiced paganism. Do you know what I mean? I'd never heard of such a thing.
Yes.
But I was like, this is what I'm going to do.
That is awesome, and that journey must have been incredible, to discover that there were other people, and to compare what they were doing with what people were doing in antiquity, and how you reconciled and juggled all those things until you... you found what worked for you.
Yes, yes. I mean, it took a lot of doing, as you can imagine. So I don't think I met anybody else who would have identified as a pagan until I was about 13. And then I met my first pagan, and it was great. But at that time, I think the emphasis was very heavily on, like, Wicca.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not as interested in that. Not that I don't have an interest in, like, magic, you know, ceremonial magic or witchcraft. But to me, that was sort of different than what I was trying to do. I was more interested in what people had done in antiquity and updating that for the present day and sort of skipping over the whole Middle Ages thing. So it took a long time before I met other people who were interested in that as I was. And I should say, I've never been heavily interested in Reconstructionism, only because I don't think that works. And when it comes to Northern Europe, we just don't have the data. Do you know what I mean? Thanks to the fact that Christianity hit Northern Europe sort of before literacy, widespread literacy did, we just don't have the record. So even though I'm only like a quarter Italian, I keep getting, I kept getting drawn back into the classics because this is what we know most about. I would love to discover some hitherto unknown source that, you know, talks about what the Druids actually did. But right now, we just don't know. So.
Well, it's been a colorful evolution to what the Druids are now doing. But again, with a lot of what is called paganism, the scholarship was based on popular works at the time that have since been discredited in many cases. So the history is very interesting, though.
Yeah, you mean Margaret Murray. Yes.
I like Margaret Murray, though. There are a couple of insights that she had that I don't think anybody else could have presented them like she did. And I took the insights because they shed a lot of light on some things that were important to me. There are other authors, too, like Burkert. Now he's no longer seen in favor, but he had some pretty good insights with some things as well.
Yes, yes. I remember Homo Necans. That was
yes.
A great book, but yeah, that's true. And yeah, Margaret Murray does have her points, but I remember, because, you know, I read her when I was like in high school, and for a while I was completely taken with her hypothesis, but then at a certain point, I remember she claimed that Joan of Arc was sacrificed, you know, as a ritual victim, was probably, you know, a pagan. And then I read Joan of Arc's trial transcripts, and I was like, oh, my God, this lady was like a complete fundamentalist Christian. Like, definitely not. Very courageous woman, but, yeah, really hardcore on the Christianity. So I don't know where she got that from. But.
How about the folklorists? Because, again, they had some insights. A lot of their stuff was once accepted, and now it's discredited. Like what with Robert Graves, for example, or with Leyland's material, but it contributed a lot to the evolution of the modern forms of paganism.
They did, you know, and I mean, I love Robert Graves for many reasons. I love his poetry. I love I Claudia. Mm-hmm. He was a fabulous writer. I did read The White Goddess back in the day, and it did make a big impact on me. But I will say I sat down, I don't know, a couple months ago maybe, to read it over again, and I was like, oh, my God, he is all over the place. But I think a lot of what these authors brought to the table, which is really important, they brought back a lot of archetypes. Like, I don't think Graves' hypotheses are literally true, but he was absolutely right in the sense that with the sort of loss of the concept of a feminine divinity, a lot of magic did go out of the world. You know what I mean? We really lost something with that. So he was absolutely correct about that, and that is valuable and important, even if some of his other scholarship is a little shaky.
Ellen Harrington, too, she's not really, I haven't heard her talked about in quite a while, but she has some really startling insights as well in her work. And she's the one that popularized the concept of the Agathos Daemon. And she had some pictures of art that I've never come across anywhere else. She's high on my list. I have like three of her books somewhere on my bookshelves.
Oh, that's great. Oh, I'll have to check her out. Yeah. Yeah, so it's been a long, strange journey, and it's still ongoing. And, I don't know. I guess if I had to describe myself, in fact, a lot of times if I want to avoid the label of pagan, if it seems advisable to do so, I think I would really describe myself as a Neoplatonist.
Okay.
That would be the closest thing. which totally throws people off. Nobody knows what the hell that is, and they don't usually ask any questions.
We have a monthly theurgy show on my channel.
Oh.
So, and it's Llewellyn authors mostly. It's Brandy Williams. It's Jean-Louis de Biasi. It's Apollonius, a.k.a. Bruce McLellan, a.k.a. John Opsopeos. It's Tony Mrzewicki, occasionally Patrick Dunn. So if you'd like to be part of that, we've been doing this for like years now. Once a month, we've been having like these theurgy conversations and sharing insights and thoughts on a wide variety of topics. It sounds like you would fit right in to that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That would be great fun.
Oh, awesome.
That would be. So if I may... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Sure, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, so you yourself identify as an Olympian, right?
Yes, I identify as an Olympian. The term pagan, I'm ambivalent about it because it literally means country dweller. And like the word heathen. So when I lived in the mountains of the Poconos, Pennsylvania, people would ask me if I'm a pagan. I'd say, yes, now that I live in Pennsylvania in the woods on a mountain, yes, I would categorize myself as a pagan. But when I lived in New York City or other urban places, no, I wouldn't. I'm not a Reconstructionist. I believe that my spirituality is like an evolution from the past. It's firmly rooted in the past, and I greatly respect the past. And I, too, am grateful that a lot of the spiritual literature has been preserved because of classical education and the West's preoccupation with Greece and Rome. I don't really do what pagans do. Like, I don't really observe the holidays. I don't really worship the gods. I see that I'm Greek. So I went to Greek parochial school, and half the time we learned Greek history, the other time English history and sundry other subjects. So I had a really great foundation in history, in the mythology, in the superstitions, in the religions, in the smatterings of the languages. I had that as part of my heritage, and Greeks, even though they're Greek Orthodox, are very proud of their pagan past, and they even have a heaven for virtuous pagans. So my parents concluded at a very young age that that's where I was going, because I certainly wasn't going where they were going, and that it was okay that we visit, because, we're Greek, so it's okay to visit. Visit your family and your loved ones in different heavens. So that's kind of like what I grew up with. And I rebelled against that, of course, like everybody does, and wandered around and tried many different things, both Eastern and Western. But my journey eventually brought me back a full circle, and I'm really happy, and I learned a lot of things along the way.
Yes. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I was so excited once. I have a friend who's Orthodox, and she pointed out and sent me pictures of images in Orthodox churches of, like, Plato. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I was like, oh, my God. That would never be allowed. Icons, yeah.
Yeah,
that would never
be
allowed.
Hercules was syncretized into St. Luke.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That seems like a stretch.
There's some graffiti. Well, during the time when Christianity was rising, Hercules was a healer god. So he had not only the gymnasium, but also hot springs. And his cultus, which focused on the healing, was very competitive with Asclepius's cult at the time, too. So when it came time to fold the old gods and heroes into the new religion, Hercules was equated with the dear and glorious physician. And I don't remember which book I read it in, but on one of the icons of St. Luke, there was some complaining graffiti written by Hercules saying, look what happened to me.
Oh, no. Yeah, there was so much of that. I have a friend who is Sicilian, who grew up in Sicily, and he said, okay, this is how he describes the Christian conversion of Europe. He says it was basically like the Christian said, oh, you're having a party? Oh, that's great. We're going to come to your party, and we'll bring some food, and we're going to put up some decorations, okay? And thus was the West converted. Just, yeah, different iconography, but...
And the folklore continued. I remember when I was growing up and visiting Greece, my parents would go there quite often. I witnessed a satyr type of festival on the island of Limnos, which is where my ancestry is. And they were still jumping over bonfires. And the church kind of tolerated it. It's what the people did. So they had all these... the festivals or practices that were tied to Christian festivals, and they had beliefs in the Kalikanzari or the Xotika, the elementals and the nature spirits, and there were all these stories told about them. And I remember one time I got sick, and the doctor said he couldn't do anything, so I had to go to a wise person. And they chanted what sounded like arithmetic from what I can catch, and threw... cloves in pieces of charcoal, and occasionally when they intoned something, the cloves would explode. It was all very dramatic, and a lot of that survived till very, very late. And even when I was old enough to travel on my own, initially when I try to collect some of these stories, initially people would say, oh no, nobody believes in that anymore. But then when they got to know me and saw that I was sincere and that I had stories of my own to share, all of a sudden the floodgates opened up to all these true accounts of the Kalikanzari and, you know, what they're really like in Neraidus that still plagued people with all sorts of things. And then the lights that led people, you know, in their sleep, and then they'd wake up miles from home or kilometers from home. So I got to appreciate that part of my heritage as something that was still living and breathing, and it wasn't something that had died and was inside just a book, but it was something that was still in the minds and hearts and practices of the people.
Oh my God, yes. You're so, so lucky that you had that.
Yes.
Yeah. I had to get most of the folklore from books, which is something I was always interested in. But other than joining the local Morris dance troupe, there wasn't a lot I could do in the United States.
Cool. So you really studied this, and it shows in not only our conversation, but in the book that you put together. What gave you the idea to write this book? Because it's awesome.
So, well, thank you very much. So weirdly enough, I first had the idea to do this about 20 years ago. But what I really wanted to do, I should preface this by saying I used to work as a professional musician. I was a harpist, and as a harpist, I spent a lot of time in churches, as you may very well imagine, playing at services or, doing weddings or funerals or all that sort of thing. And as part of my music education, for a class I did on theory and composition, I spent a year singing in an Episcopalian choir, which did some wonderful music. And I was like, you know, we should have a pagan hymnal, right? That would be really neat, because there is so much, there's a lot of folk music that could reasonably be regarded as having a pagan origin. And there is also a lot of classical music that was written, you know, to celebrate various myths, various deities. So I was like, this would be really easy. And I thought I could also intersperse it with text. So I ran around collecting all the music that I could, and I actually had a publisher interested in it, but at the time I was a true pagan, I was living in a state forest in a little house that had never had electricity, central heating, or running water. And it was just too much, do you know what I mean? I couldn't put the manuscript together then, particularly with the musical notation, because I needed a computer program to make it legible, and so it just wasn't happening. So I put the idea on the back burner, and then I sort of brought it out and dusted it out a couple years ago And I found out that there wasn't much interest in music. I think this is because almost nobody can read even simple music anymore. But there was an interest in a more literary creation. I was like, oh, I was an English major. I can do this. Hands down, no problem. So that's what got me going.
Wow. I'm sure as you write more books, and I'm assuming you're going to write more books, that'll be something that you could dust off and and publish, because I'm sure people will be interested in it.
Yeah, yeah, there is a wonderful, it basically went the same way as literature went in the West. You know, there was a preservation of the sort of folkloric traditions which often involve music. I mean, to think of an example, there's the English custom which persisted, I think, organically into the late 19th and early 20th century and has since been revived of, for instance, going out and singing to the apple trees at the end of the year and, you know, making offerings to the apple trees and asking them, you know, to bear fruit in the coming season. So you have that sort of whole category of folk music that seems to be connected to at least some sort of animism, if not directly to ancient paganism. And then you have the classical tradition, which, just like in literature, nobody ever stopped writing music for Pan, you know, or for
right.
Apollo, or yeah. So there is a lot there.
And you organized the book in a very good way, not by pantheon or not by deities in alphabetical order, but by month. There are so many different pagan holidays that we know of. How did you narrow down your choices?
So a big part of the book, of all aspects of the book, was what I could get. So there were holidays that I wanted to include that I just couldn't find, you know, enough material for, or enough good material for, or I couldn't get the copyright to things that I wanted, you know, maybe to include. And so I went with the big ones, the big holidays, and then sort of included anything else that I thought I could get enough material for. And I wanted it to be a synthesis of, you know, first of all, as many traditions as possible, but also I wanted it to be something that could be sort of a guide throughout the year. I think in the back of my head, maybe I shouldn't say this, but it's true, I was influenced by, you know, like the Book of Common Prayer, by the books that you could go into any church, any Christian church, and pick up. And I'm like, well, we should be able to have something similar, you know, for the pagan year. And I angsted over some things. I decided to start it with January. I mean, I know a lot of modern American pagans sort of think of the beginning of the year as being Samhain, as being the 1st of November, because that was the new year for the insular Celts. And that's the origin of our Halloween festivities. And I sort of went back and forth with that, but I was like, you know what, January 1st is the date that we all celebrate, whether we like it or not, as the beginning of the new year, and it is a pagan holiday already. So let's start there, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and this way it really enhances the eclectic nature of the book, because the year is something that people are familiar with. And by going month to month, they're exposed to, you know, different deities and their hymns and invocations and so forth. So there's a lot to experiment with. And somebody who knows their way around, you have a very great collection of things, you know. So it's like, oh, I didn't even know about this. So I enjoyed that aspect of your book a lot.
Yes, well, thank you. Like I said, I got the book that I got, not necessarily the book that in a perfect world I would have wanted, but I tried to think a lot too about, okay, what makes sense for American pagans as opposed to, you know, pagans somewhere in Europe. So I think a more eclectic approach makes sense. I also tried to keep it too, because, I mean, okay, if we're going to talk about all pagan cultures, past and present, the book would be enormous. You know, it would be filled with things from all over the world. But because I thought about both the sort of the literary history of the West, which America inherited and then, you know, expanded upon, and I was also thinking about, okay, how do American pagans identify? It was like they either, for the most part, obviously it's a very diverse group, but for the most part, they're either working within a classical tradition, within a Germanic tradition, or within a Celtic tradition. So that was how I included those particular groups. And I threw in the Near Eastern for a couple of reasons, partially because the Near Eastern material is so old and so wonderful. The Near Eastern, and I should say the Egyptian, but also because these traditions were at least somewhat syncretized with, like, the Mediterranean traditions in antiquity. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel like I was, you know, stepping out of bounds.
And they've been brought back by the ancient astronaut theorists. So in popular literature, the ancient Near Eastern pantheons are alive and well.
I don't think I knew that. Thank you for telling me. I knew about the ancient astronaut enthusiasts. I've been on a couple of train rides with some, but was not aware that they were into Inanna, but that's good to know.
Oh, yes, yes, definitely. And there are also festivals like I usually speak during the pandemic long distance via Zoom. But I'm usually a speaker at Ishtar Fest, which is here on the in like New Jersey, Pennsylvania area.
Oh, wonderful! Oh, that's neat. That's great.
Yeah, I was surprised to find in the ancient astronaut literature people so familiar with the ancient Near Eastern pantheons. I've since read and talked to lots of people about that subject, but it sprang, and a lot of really obscure Hebrew literature too is now something you could easily find, you know, in a popular bookstore.
Yes. Oh, that's fascinating. Well, that's good. The gods want to come back to Earth, I guess, and they're going to do it in many ways.
So you identified yourself as a Neoplatonist. What is it about Neoplatonism that sparks that resonance in you?
So I would say that my conception from the time I was quite young, I don't really know exactly where the roots of it are. I don't know where these conceptions sprang from in my mind. I would suspect maybe some popular ideas from theosophy that were sort of floating around. But I guess I should say I'm not really a strict polytheist. I do worship many gods and goddesses, and I think that's great and wonderful. But I do sort of ultimately conceive of them as being aspects of a godhead that is without form, certainly without gender, do you know what I mean, without name. And then the power flows down from that into many deities, and then sort of spirits that are not quite deities. So that was how I was sort of thinking of things from a very early point, no doubt influenced by, like I say, Neoplatonist influences that I wasn't even aware of. So when I first started reading about it in college, I was like, yes, I think that this might be exactly what I am. So it gave me a framework for what I already was, if that makes any sense at all.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense. From what little I can glean about you from the internet and from Llewellyn's site, it mentions that you were also involved in the book industry for many years.
Oh, yes. Well, so I started off my working life as a bookseller, you know, working in bookstores because, of course, I love to read, and that made sense. So I did that for a number of years. And then while I was doing that, I got my degree at Penn. at the University of Pennsylvania, and then I ended up working for close to 5 years for the University of Pennsylvania Press.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah. And right now I just started a new job at Princeton University Press. So.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. Yep, I love working with books.
I think I've dealt with both of those presses at one point or another on podcasts over the years. That is incredibly awesome. I love books myself. We had a small metaphysical bookstore in Pennsylvania for a while. So even though long-term it didn't really pan out for us, it was something that was really high on my bucket list. So I got to experience that for a number of years. So everyone has dreams for their artistry, for their creativity that they put forth into the world. What would you like a year of pagan prayer to accomplish? What impact would you like it to have on the world?
I think I would like to make modern pagans, or however they identify, aware of the fact that I guess that the past of the West belongs to us every bit as much, you know what I mean, as it belongs to Christianity and to Christians, the past and the present. I feel like there's been a divorce, historically speaking, between people who identify as pagans and the sort of more mainstream traditions of the West, whether it's literary, whether it's musical. And I think that's a terrible shame. And I don't fully, particularly in when we're talking about classical literature and classical thought, classical philosophy, I don't know exactly how this happened, but I think that people who are pagans don't think of, like, Cicero as a pagan. You know what I mean? They don't think of Plato as being a pagan. It's just there's this sort of mental divide. And, you know, also when people think of paganism, they don't usually think of Keats or Oscar Wilde or, you know, people who had a deep interest in paganism, even if they were not themselves pagan, and who produced beautiful works in honor of the pagan god. So I think I would like to make people more aware of that, so that they feel that they're sort of not this isolated, you know, fringe, eccentric, weird thing, that we really are a part of the mainstream and always have been, that our tradition has been. And I also wanted to make a practical book that people could use to incorporate beautiful things from the past into their present practices. You know, there's definitely nothing wrong with, you know, writing your own prayers on the fly, you know, writing your own rituals on the fly, but this will give maybe a little something extra to people. So that's what I hope for.
And I like how you suggest that on the Llewellyn website. You wrote a piece on, I guess, ways that people can use the book. And that was something you encouraged people to do. I always think that people should do that too, should adapt from antiquity, but make it their own. So,
yes.
And there's a lot in this book to make your own, or even to use as is. There's a phenomenal amount. If someone were to take a journey throughout the year, like if you could be a tour guide through your book, and somebody started, let's say, in January, which isn't that far away, and made their way through the book throughout the entire year, is there anything you think they should focus on particularly as they're wending their way through the book on this annual journey?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. What I guess the thing that I would suggest that people focus on is how much of the past is already with us in the present. For example, you know, okay, if we started on January 1st with the feast day of Janus, I mean, we already, even if you don't know the name of that god, you already know him. This is his holiday, you know, this is, the month is named for him, you know, and as you go through the year, June is obviously named for Juno, And so you can celebrate her feast day on the very first of the month. And, of course, with March, we have Mars. I would like people to realize how much, to pay attention to how much of this is all around us and has always been all around us. And it's just a matter of sort of shifting your emphasis a little bit, maybe from the entirely modern Christianized world, and you'll see that it's all right there, and it always has been.
And that is important to realize, too. In fact, the other day, Tony Merzwicki and I, on his show, which is Living Illuminated Moss on the channel, we had a conversation about this very fact, and we were focusing on popular culture and how immersed in the classical era mythology and history our popular culture is. And all those references are there since from the time you're kids till the time you leave the planet. So by osmosis, you absorb a lot of this stuff, and it isn't unfamiliar. It's very familiar.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I don't want to go off on one of my rants about the horrors that the lack of classical, the decision to abandon a classical education, in my opinion, has visited upon America. But it's like at some point, I guess, probably in the 60s or the 70s, it's like we collectively decided that it wasn't really important to teach the languages and teach the literature that we had been teaching for thousands of years in the West, right? That was all done with. We're going to be modern, don't need Latin, don't need Greek, don't need to read all of these dead men. But the funny thing is, and, you know, people, I think, often have a conception if they hear names like Cicero or Plato or Aristotle, they think, oh, you know, it's terribly weighty, the classical world is difficult, it's boring. But, you know, for example, Rome is always big box office.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And very often so is Greece. And, like, people love this. They love these stories, you know, whether it's I, Claudius, or Gladiator, or Cleopatra back in the day. You know, people flock to this. And I think it's an utter travesty that we've decided to, in some ways, just really turn our backs on this. So
I think so, too. And as we were talking the other day with Tony, that the myths have always lived in popular culture. Homer was a bard. A lot of the playwrights who preserved the material from getting lost were writing for crowds of people in a theater. The plates, they didn't have comic books or magazines, but they had plates and craters and cups and all sorts of things with mythical scenes on them. So they've always lived in the popular culture. And in some weird way, people who are exposed to popular culture become curious, and then they go on to become the scholars, which go dig into what's actually there and again, revive it and modernize it. So, it seems that these stories live and they're alive, whether they're historical or mythical, and that's okay, too. So we could choose to forget them, but they're not going to be forgotten. They'll live on in our entertainment, as you pointed out.
Yes, yes. That's some hope, right?
Now, are any other books on the horizon? Are you working on a project now that you could talk about?
A friend of mine pointed out to me that there was absolutely no literature really widely available for pagan children, specifically very young children. And this is a friend of mine who actually had been a pagan but then became Orthodox. So she went the opposite way that you did. But, you know, part of the reason she did that was because when she was raising very young children, the pagan spaces at that time were not necessarily highly kid-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there wasn't a lot of resources for parents who wanted to raise their children as pagans. So I did a small children's book, like suitable, a text suitable for a picture book, describing sort of the year and the different main holidays of the year. Through a retelling, it's really a retelling of Demeter and Persephone, but I don't name them. I just call them the mother and the maiden, keep everything very, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done that, and I'll see if I can get a publisher for that. And
oh,
then,
awesome.
Of course, my other interests are, I shouldn't even mention this because it's going to make me sound like a crazy person, because if I say this name, everybody is going to have an image in their minds, which is not strictly accurate. So I said I love the Julio-Claudians. So for a long time, I've had an idea of doing a novel, something along the lines of Robert Graves' wonderful I, Claudius, or As Close as I Could Come, about the Emperor Gaius, who, of course, is better known by his nickname, Caligula. Yeah. But, of course, the Caligula that has come down to us through popular culture, especially through that film that Bob Guccione did, is not very accurate. So I wanted to do a more historically accurate look at Caligula as a novel. So I'm working on that now.
That should be very interesting. I forget who the name is, like at the tip of my mind, on the tip of my tongue, but I can't. He was a very popular writer for a while, and he had written the book that the movie was based on,
yes,
and they changed a lot of the book. Anyway,
Gore Vidal.
Gore Vidal.
Who wrote that wonderful novel Julian about Julian the Apostate?
Yes, the Apostate.
Yeah,
yes.
Which. Yeah, that book had a great influence on me when I was about 19. But yeah, he wrote the screenplay for Caligula, and apparently he was so upset when he saw it. He was like, because I think it was supposed to be called Gore Vidal's Caligula.
Uh-huh.
And when he saw the movie, he was like, get my name the hell off that, or I'm suing. There is no way.
Yeah, I remember that at the time. It was in the magazines, and the whole thing was one big drama unfolding.
Yes. And, of course, the movie had precious little to do with Caligula. But, obviously, there is a religious aspect to this, too, because Caligula had kind of a fraught relationship, maybe, I don't know, with the gods, but certainly with the gods in the mind of his contemporaries. He seems to have been one of the first to, or the first to attempt to institute a cult of the emperor as a living person, as opposed to the cult of the dead Augustus and deified Augustus. So, yeah, that's going to be very interesting.
I'm looking forward to that book. I'm looking forward to your children's book. Are you still a musician, or are you still doing music?
I play a little bit for myself. I don't go out and play anymore. At least I haven't in years. But, yeah, I have three harps, so I do play from time to time. Two Celtic harps and a classical harp.
Have you recorded your music? Do you have any albums or... places where somebody could stream your music?
I do not. No, alas. I never have. Maybe one day I thought of it. But it's become kind of such a thing. When I started playing the Celtic harp before I went to the classical harp, like nobody played the harp. I mean, this was a long time ago. Nobody played a harp. Nobody had ever seen a harp. And then in the intervening years, of course, harpists are like everywhere now, and Celtic harp, and yeah, it's a thing. So maybe I'll wait for the current wave of enthusiasm to die down a little bit and then sneak back in.
Well, something else to look forward to. Any plans to keep A Year of Pagan Prayer as an evolving work, like updated every few years or modified every few years?
I would love to. I mean, if there's the demand for it, I would be happy to, because, you know, this is the agonizing thing about doing an anthology, because as soon as you're done and it's typeset, you come across a poem and you're like, oh, my God, I I didn't have that. Why didn't I have that at the time? I wish I had. So, yeah, I've got a list going. And if it sells well, I would be thrilled to do an updated edition.
Now, you're very articulate. Have you ever done any public speaking? Because you're phenomenally articulate.
You're really kind. Do you know I'm actually tongue-tied? I have a speech impediment.
Really?
Yes.
That did not come across at all.
Yes. I think that's part of why I learned to articulate very well, because, you know, when I was little, I had to go to speech therapy, and I guess it stuck. No, I've never done any public speaking. I was always the musician behind the harp and never had to speak much in public. But I like to read. I like to talk. What can I say? They go together.
Well, That's a route that if you're interested in taking, I'm sure it'll be there for you. This is an excellent book, and even if you spoke about your book, you know, to live audiences, you communicate very well. So they'd love to listen to you speak.
Thank you.
So where do you see, because you're in the publishing industry. You play music for yourself, you've written a wonderful book, and you have other wonderful books, one sitting on a shelf and two of them evolving and seeking to find their place. Where do you see your journey taking you, like, in the next 10 years or so?
Oh, my God. If this were 10 years ago, I might have an answer to give you.
Okay.
As it is, I've learned that it's just not wise to try to make these sorts of long-term plans, perhaps even in one's head. I don't know. All I think I can say is I will go where the gods take me just keep trying to do the best that I can for them. I mean, obviously, in 10 years' time, I would love to be Empress of the United States, but that is not going to happen.
Awesome.
So.
Well, there was an Emperor Norton at one point.
There was, in San Francisco, yes.
And the United States indulged him and allowed him to keep his title and printed his own money. And so you never know. It is possible.
It is, yeah. So I think an empress would be a particularly hard sell. But, yeah. In my own life, I just try to make, you know, each year better than the last, and hopefully I'll be allowed to continue to do that and to read and write and maybe draw some people back to the old gods.
All very noble goals and very well said. Now, you are obviously someone who is accomplished and who has followed your own unique path and has made progress on it. A lot of people follow the scripts of our society or of their religion or, you know, whatever background they have or however they identify, and they live scripts. What would you say to folks who want to go past the scripts but are afraid to? Because you've gone past many of them.
Well, I would just say there's really nothing to be afraid of. I suppose perhaps you mean the difficulty that humans feel in breaking away from the herd. I do think that there are probably sound evolutionary reasons for this. Do you know what I mean? It's in our distant past, it was very dangerous, you know, for humans to break away from the tribe, to break away from the clan, because physical death was a real reality. But we don't have to worry about that anymore. I think a lot of people fear social death if they break outside of the norms. But honestly, our world is constructed now so that unless all of the people you know are really awful, that's not something that you need to be afraid of. I've really never had much of an issue. And you know, if you run into people, friends, family, even strangers, who want to give you a hard time for choosing a different path, I found that if you are pleasant and open and you explain your reasons, most people are not going to give you that hard a time. And if they're really going to, you should probably get the hell away from them anyway. So just don't be afraid. Don't be haunted by ancestral fear. We don't have to all move in the same direction anymore, and we shouldn't.
Thank you so very much. How can people enter your world? Where can they go to get your book? And how can they find out more about you and tap into whatever you would like to share with the world at this time?
Well, as you've pointed out, I am a little bit reclusive, but I'm happy, very happy to say that the book is widely available. You know, it's carried by Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available in a whole bunch of bricks and mortar bookstores, and any bricks and mortar bookstore can order it for you. So that's easily accessible. As for myself, I can always be written to care of my publisher. I should say I do have some nascent social media accounts, but they're just in their infancy. So I guess probably the one I pay most attention to is my Twitter account, which is my name. It's at Barbara Nolan 361. And the 361 is a reference to the Emperor Julian and the date that he reintroduced paganism into Rome, unsuccessfully as it happened, but he tried.
He tried.
He tried, yes. So,
I enjoyed speaking with you a great deal, and please be expecting an invitation to join our Theurgy Forum in the very near future, and I'll also be posting a very positive review of your book on Amazon sometime during the next week. I really enjoyed the book. I'll be experimenting with it for quite a while, and thank you for writing it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Hercules. Thank you for having me on, and I look forward to talking with you further.
Awesome. And thanks to everybody who tuned in tonight, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you're in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And we're going to close with Virginia Ackley's If You Can Dream. Thanks again, Barbara.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake, dream till you feel, dream till you know it, dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be bound by love and yet be free, but only if you can dream. When love and trust are deep and fair, there is nothing you're heart won't dare, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream. Till it's real. Dream till it's real.